You're listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story. Living on Gumbunya country in Australia, this is your host, Lucy Van Sandy. Welcome back to Talk the Walk. Today we're joined in the Yarning Chair by Emma Searle, who for the last 11 years has been working as the Senior Social Worker at the Royal Hospital for Women in Sydney. Emma is part of the Aboriginal Maternal and Infant Health Service, known as Malabar Midwifery Group Practice, that cares for Aboriginal families having a baby at the hospital. Emma finds herself working mostly with urban Indigenous families with identified risk of harm issues or child protection involvement. It is through this work that Emma became aware of two significant and concerning trends. Although Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander families make up 2% of births at the Royal Hospital for Women, they comprise well over 50% of births with child protection involvement. Secondly, due to the shortage of Indigenous staff within Health and FACTS, the Child Protection Agency in New South Wales, non-Indigenous practitioners are overrepresented in terms of the health and welfare professionals who make the decisions about the care and protection needs of Indigenous families. Emma is very passionate about asking questions and exploring the realities of what it means as a non-Indigenous social worker to support Aboriginal women and their families at the pointy end of things. So in 2014, she set off on a Churchill Fellowship to find out if other countries had similar trends and what they might be doing to better engage vulnerable Indigenous clients in their services. I'm really looking forward to exploring with Emma what she's learned and what a difference this is making to her social work practice today. So welcome to Talk the Walk, Emma. I appreciate you making the time to, come and chat with us today.
Thanks, Lucy. It's great to be talking with you from Eora country.
And there's so much I would love to explore with you. I was wondering if we could start by just getting a bit of an idea on what your role at the hospital looks like, maybe what a typical day looks like for you.
It's pretty varied. Something that I really love about hospital social work is that you never know what's going to come through the door or where you'll end up for that matter. So you might think you've got a day of clinics and meetings and you find yourself with a woman trying to break into her car in King's Cross in the middle of a thunderstorm unexpectedly. So I'm really fortunate that my role is very flexible. So I'm not stuck at the hospital per se. We work care for women from lots of different parts of the city of Sydney, I guess, and eastern Sydney, so La Perouse and Woolloomooloo and Darlinghurst, and we've got a partnership with the AMS at Redfern as well. So we go to clinics in different places. My role is a real mix of direct client work and indirect work, so case planning or consultancy with midwives and other staff. A typical day could include individual appointments for counselling or case management, advocacy around housing, lots of things like that. Meetings with a family and FACTS where risk of harm issues have been identified. So that might be before a baby's born with perinatal family conferencing or after a baby's born where there's a safety and risk assessment. And sometimes I'll have two of those meetings in a day with different families. Multidisciplinary meetings, a big part of the role is working with other staff to plan a woman's admission and look at what her support needs might be when she comes into birth. I might need to visit women on the postnatal ward or in the nursery in a newborn care centre. We can do home visits as well, antenatally or postnatally. And often I'm just a presence at the antenatal appointment with the midwives, so kind of in conjunction with them. And that's part of, I guess, the women getting a message that we all work as a team. For some women, we try not to have too many appointments for them. That gets overwhelming, so it's easy to combine the appointment with social work and their midwifery care. So, and then in the middle of all that, I might get a phone call from someone I haven't spoken to for months that needs help with housing, or get a call from the midwives to say that, you know, one of our women has been assaulted and, needs some assistance and is being brought into delivery suite. So unpredictable.
And it sounds like you're flat out, as most social workers are.
That's right.
I know something that you're very passionate about is making a difference for Indigenous women living in urban areas and making it as easy as possible for them to access the care and support they need in pregnancy and in birthing. Can you speak about some of the factors that are impacting on their likelihood of reaching out for support, especially when they have child protection closely scrutinising them?
A lot of historical factors that understandably impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women accessing some mainstream healthcare. So I think particularly in urban areas, a hospital is a big government institution, and then therefore it represents government policies. So it represents, you know, the stolen generation and policies of segregation and systemic racism and things like that. So there's been horrific stories that women have shared from within their families about women taking a baby to hospital because it was sick and then coming home without the baby because the baby was removed while they were there. And those stories kind of, they travel down through the generations. So I think when that's part of a family story, it's hard for them to access care and trust the big white institution, essentially. But secondly, a lot of women associate child protection involvement, or for that matter, social work involvement, with automatic child removal. So they just put those two things together. So it's, and that might be from their experiences of immediate family or family in the past or from friends, but it's also what they've heard on the street about what happens when you go to hospital or when you engage with certain services. And we have a lot of women, for instance, that may be taking drugs during pregnancy, and they know that that's not ideal, but they're frightened of that that will mean an automatic removal, so they may not engage up until the very last minute. Yeah, so that's quite challenging, and that's one of the factors. I guess we're competing with hearsay and history.
Yeah, right. So is there a real gap for those women then that basically don't engage with your service? What happens to those women?
The service was originally, one of the reasons it was kind of created in the first place was to address this issue that a lot of Aboriginal women won't engage in maternity care until very late, and that can have different outcomes for health and risk of harm issues and things like that. So I think, yeah, so my position's funded through a federal funding through Close the Gap, the New Directions program, and what we've seen is that through providing midwifery care through specialised teams, that women are starting to engage earlier. Yeah, to kind of close that gap of not coming up until the last minute. Yeah, so it's still a gap, and it's still a challenge to engage women, because there's still stories out there, I guess, about what will happen if you go to the hospital and if you tell the health professionals about what you're experiencing. But at the end of the day, I think the encouraging thing is we still see women coming, even if it's at the very end of their pregnancy, they will still come because they know, you know, what's best for their baby, and they seek that care.
Yeah, awesome. Let's look at this second issue that you were really interested in addressing, and that is the overrepresentation of non-Indigenous health workers, because that's something that prevents women from engaging, I guess, as well. Can you speak about some of the struggles you've experienced as a non-Indigenous social worker working with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, and prior to you setting out on your Churchill Fellowship, how you were working through some of those challenges?
Before I started at the Royal, I was already aware from my time working in Wagga and Albury of, you know, some of the challenges that Aboriginal families and communities face. But I think working with Aboriginal families, like, every day, kind of I was really confronted by how up against it a lot of Aboriginal people are, and with issues of chronic health and suicide and things like that. There's so many funerals that they've got to go to, and grief and loss, and the impact of incarceration. So just all these kind of ongoing issues. But I found that there was the challenge of facing that and then seeing my own power and privilege as well, and issues such as gratuitous concurrence. So talking with an Aboriginal person that's just agreeing with whatever you're saying, because historically they've been told, you know, when a white person asks you a question, you just agree and go along with the dominant system. So I found that quite confronting, and and challenging to engage women therapeutically or to find out what they really thought and what they really needed at that point in time, because there was a sense that they might be too scared to share that. But reflecting on it, I think a lot of the challenges of the role are actually the same as working with any vulnerable pregnant women. So it's not so much that you're a white social worker, it's the fact you're a social worker is the reason that people don't want to work with you. So I had the experience of working in Scotland for a couple of years, and that was really useful to show me that the effects of poverty and trauma are universal, just as the effects of desire to work with social work or not work with social work is universal. So I think that the way I've addressed that challenge is just to try and clarify what my role is with the women and really spend time building relationship so that they do get to that position where they trust you. Practicing transparently is very important to me, and I think that's a good way to break down some of the stigma of the role and that power imbalance that can happen. But it's also ensuring that other staff are aware of what the social work role is, because I think when other non-Indigenous staff are faced with similar challenges, sometimes there's a desire to not make things worse. So they're like, oh, we, you know, everything's fine until the social worker comes along and asks her questions and meddles, this do-gooder. But it's also from a place of, these Aboriginal families have been through so much already. I don't want to make anything worse. I don't want to cause more trauma by having a difficult conversation. So we'll just act like everything is fine. And yeah, so that can be a big challenge.
So in 2013, you applied for a Churchill Fellowship. Can you speak about what your thinking was behind your application and what you set out to achieve?
I found that there were lots of occasions where I was frequently having these thoughts about, so I'd sit in a room or find myself in a room having, you know, maybe supporting a family through a risk assessment with FACTS and child protection. And I'd look around the room and I was like, here we are, predominantly white professionals making decisions with an Aboriginal woman, but yeah, predominantly non-Indigenous people in the room, making decisions about, you know, the health and welfare needs of the family and what happens next. And I kind of thought, how far have we really come? Like, we're still here in this place doing this and it's still non-Indigenous people making these decisions. And I was also aware of, my experience has generally been that the earlier that women engage with antenatal care, if they've got risk of harm issues happening, the better the outcomes are. So the more likely they are to go home with their baby if they engage earlier with services and people can really work with them. So I was like, well, how do we do that? How do we engage them, given that we've got this really difficult history in Australia of child removal and, you know, very European kind of domination of those decision-making processes? And that led me to think, surely they've got similar, similar challenges in other parts of the world that have the same kind of history of British occupation. And I looked at the data and it indicated that that would be the case. So in New Zealand, Canada and the United States, the Indigenous population is anywhere from 2 to 14%, yet they're vastly overrepresented when it comes to things like incarceration, children in out-of-home care, admissions to hospital for violence and things like that. So I thought, given this data, there's going to be social workers in other parts of the world that face those same challenges. And I thought, I wonder how they engage Indigenous women in a culturally competent way and address some of these challenges that are happening in the here and now. Because it's also about, we, some of these issues are because we don't have enough Aboriginal health staff or Aboriginal child protection staff. So it's like, how do we, it's working in parallel with that issue. So we support Indigenous people to get qualified, but in the meantime, how can we as non-Indigenous staff practice better or practice the best we can?
So as part of your fellowship, you travelled extensively across the USA, Canada and New Zealand, talking with different agencies, hospitals and professionals about their experience supporting women in pregnancy and birthing. What did you find, what did you discover about these services that was similar to your experience here in Australia?
Well, some places it was honestly like looking in a mirror. It was really quite spooky how similar it was, particularly in Canada and particularly with urban areas. So a big focus of my inquiry, I guess, was to find out the specific needs of Indigenous women in urban areas, because I'm aware that can be quite different to rural and remote. And sometimes Aboriginal people tend to be all kind of lumped in together and there's generalisations about what their needs are. So that was particularly relevant for one theme which emerged and was very similar to what we encounter in our practice, and that's that Aboriginal women in urban areas might be quite dislocated from their culture or disconnected. Mm-hmm. And that might be because they have chosen to remove themselves from their community. So they may have chosen to move to Sydney to get away from their community. They may have been asked to leave their community. There's lots of different reasons why they might be disconnected from that culture. We also have women that they've grown up with the non-Aboriginal part of their family. So they feel a bit of shame about identifying as Aboriginal, or they're not sure if they're allowed to because they don't have that close community connection. I encountered, you know, across my travels, they had the same issue that there's women that feel like they've been told you're not Aboriginal enough to access these services, and then they go to other places and they're not white enough for certain things. So it's in this kind of limbo land. But that was significant because the data shows us that connection to culture is a protective factor for children. So, I think that's why that's significant. So a lot of women not knowing their traditional language, which is, again, that's something I encountered all over the world because they were prevented from speaking it. So the impact of colonisation on that. Another similarity was that grandparents are often, you know, they're the best option, or kinship care is the best option for when a child needs to come into care, but those carers are often already facing their own health issues or caring for other children, or so there's issues of sustainability and how do we support those placements to last, and because that's the best option. There was a shortage of Indigenous health staff everywhere I went. They had similar challenges, and as a result, very similar stories about a fear and distrust of non-Indigenous services based on experiences of child removal and systemic racism. And so a very similar kind of situation. And there were also lots of similarities in terms of people working in, it's a bit of a cliche, but people working in silos and a lack of information sharing, which is across the board. That's not just for Indigenous families, but some of the challenges that brings up, people not kind of sharing with other service providers and how that impacts families.
So what are the implications for, I'm interested in perhaps the one that you spoke about, language. If we take that as an example, what are the implications of a woman not being able to speak her language or be immersed in her language and her culture? What are the implications of that on your service?
It's another example of how I think the European system is so dominant. Non-Indigenous culture, I guess, is so dominant that it can swallow everything else up, for want of a better term. But I often feel like our service, just by being an Aboriginal specific service and having specific resources for Aboriginal families, and we've tried hard to have more Aboriginal artwork throughout the hospital and kind of demonstrations of culture, it's giving people permission to practice their culture and take pride in their culture, because that's something before that I think their voice is kind of lost. And it's hard if they don't have a language that they can identify with, or if they don't actually know much about the nation that they're from and things like that. So it's almost, I think, non-Indigenous professionals sharing in that with them kind of gives them permission to, and builds that up and encourages them to explore that further, or as part of their identity, I guess. Yeah.
And if the hospital is acknowledging that, you know, we embrace your culture and we encourage you to practice it and engage in it with your children, and
that's right,
that it's okay to do that.
Yeah,
Yeah. In reading your report, I was also really engaged with some of the best practice success stories that you'd written up. Can you share a couple of these stories and what these discoveries might mean for Australia in providing better services for you at the hospital, and particularly those Indigenous women living in urban areas that have child protection concerns?
Yeah, well, there were so many examples of best practice. It also helped me see the best practice happening in Australia, which was encouraging when you remove yourself. I think sometimes it's easier to look back and see that. But a recurring theme that came up a lot was that there's no formula or specific method for working with vulnerable Indigenous women. So it's important to, I guess, assess women on a case-by-case basis. Mm. And it may sound strange, but some of the First Nations workers I spoke to said, you need to remember that a woman is human first and Aboriginal second. Mm-hmm. And that might sound a bit offensive, but I think what they're essentially trying to say is that we can't go into a situation assuming that they're going to need all these things because they're Aboriginal. And like I was saying before, it's often, you know, the Aboriginal experience can be generalized. So it's like, oh, they'll need, you know, X, Y, Z. This is what's going to be important to them, when actually it might be something totally different. So I saw a lot of services that really reminded me of that Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So they addressed all the practical concerns first. Mm-hmm. So this is particularly relevant, I guess, for women that are in crisis. So they addressed, you know, their housing needs, getting practically set up for baby, or helping them with the electricity bills that was their main concern, or feeding the older kids and things like that. And then building up a relationship through providing those responses, they were then in a space to have more difficult conversations with them, or reflect with them about, do you have what it takes to care for baby? And if you don't, who would you like to care for your baby? How can we support you with that? But they couldn't get to that place before until they'd met all those other needs, because the woman just, you know, didn't want to go there. She was in survival mode. Mm. So that was quite inspiring to visit some of those services. And they were very pregnancy focused as well, which really stood out to me. And a lot of it was, surprisingly simple. It sounds like Social Work 101 is kind of a reminder of some of those basic principles. One of the most influential examples of best practice that I witnessed was in New Zealand, witnessing what's known as bicultural practice. So bicultural practice has its origins in the Treaty of Waitangi, which was an agreement made in 1840 between the British Crown and the Maori chiefs, based on a set of principles or an exchange of promises, and with the aim of offering both the settlers, or the Pakeha New Zealander population, and the Indigenous population partnership and protection and participation in government. And there's a lot of debate about the effectiveness of the treaty, and I don't want to diminish, you know, the adverse impact of European domination in New Zealand, or the fact that not every New Zealander has adhered to the treaty. But what I witnessed was that it really has a big impact today, and all the health professionals are trained in like Maori customs and knowledge. And it really stood out to me that the Maori worldview is regarded as legitimate and valued in relation to other cultures as well. So as an observer, there was a real sense of, we're all in this together. Like this is part of our story in this land, and not saying one way is better than the other, but really honouring the Maori way as well. And in a way that wasn't tokenistic, which was quite inspiring. So I went to a meeting and I was greeted by a Maori chief, but then all the Pakeha social workers, or non-Maori social workers, they all sang to me in Maori as well, which was quite amazing. And I witnessed or heard about a child protection process that was happening at the time, where the decision had been made for a child to come into care, and they had prayers and blessings in Maori for that child before that child went. And just a way of acknowledging this as a way of life and giving it value, I guess. But also the other part of that was, I was introduced to the concept that everybody kind of talks about their relationship to the land, like how they fit into the story of the place. So It wasn't just Māori staff talking about their whakapapa or their genealogy and how they, you know, were connected to the land. It was other staff as well. So, for example, I would say my relationship with this land began when my ancestors sailed by boat from Scotland, England and Sweden 180 to 120 years ago. And kind of that's when my story with this land began and kind of puts it into context. So I thought, yeah, that was quite inspirational to witness. And it's a bit hard to explain. It's a big concept, but it just stood out to me that it was, not tokenistic and a way of strengthening, I guess, Indigenous culture and that pride in their identity.
Mm. In the New Zealand context, what are the statistics like around child removals compared to, say, Australia, where we don't have that bicultural kind of approach?
It's still fairly high in that Māori families are overrepresented in terms of children in out-of-home care because, unfortunately, and that's a reflection of the fact that they're overrepresented in terms of families experiencing psychosocial issues. It's still an ongoing challenge, but it will be interesting to see. My understanding is that there's been a kind of a renewed desire to adhere to the treaty since the 1980s or 1970s. So the government acknowledged that the Māori language was at risk of disappearing, and that was partly because there'd been government policy for it not to be practiced in schools and things like that. So they made that decision to make it compulsory for the Māori language to be on all, you know, brochures and signage and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I think that government decisions like that are going to have a big impact. Yeah, say 20 years down the track, it'll be interesting to see. So, it's changing. That's my observation as a white Australian. It just seemed to me that there was a lot of strength in that.
And do they do things differently in terms of when you spoke about before this idea of all the white professionals sitting in the room making the decisions? Did you notice anything different in the New Zealand context with the way decisions were being made with the more Māori staff present?
I did. One meeting that I went to, I was really impressed by, when the Māori team arrived in the room, you could just feel their presence just in terms of, I don't know, the respect for their input, I guess. And I was really impressed by how they were an essential part of the team and that the decision-making process about what was going to happen for women, what had happened so far and that kind of thing. So, it seemed to be that it was a highly valued in this particular setting, aware that, you know, it's different in lots of different settings, but they take into account some of the cultural factors that may make up, you know, a woman's care needs and things like that.
Great. So let's look at what difference it's made, having gone off and looked at all these best practices and issues that are happening in other parts of the world. What difference is it making to your work now at the Royal Hospital for Women?
My experience in New Zealand in particular and observing the bicultural practice there just reminded me of the importance of not just acknowledging that we're on Aboriginal land, but it's acknowledging the past as well. And I think making sure that we do that in ways that aren't tokenistic. So we've tried to introduce an acknowledgement of country to meetings, where there aren't necessarily Aboriginal people present, because I think it's important to do that as standard practice as part of acknowledging the story of the land. And I actually was in a facts meeting with a family last year and acknowledged that we're on Aboriginal land, and that this young woman looked so chuffed. She was just like, oh, and I think she actually went, oh, thank you, and her family went, thank you. And it just occurred to me, I was like, wow, you're actually, this is significant for you. I think we get so used to hearing it in health circles or at events and things like that, but for this vulnerable young woman, she may not actually hear that as much, and it was really, it struck me that it was like a way of acknowledging your story is important to us. And she was just so taken aback. I was quite surprised. But a significant proportion of our families also, they have a history of child protection involvement, either themselves as children, so a lot have been in care themselves or had FACTS involvement, or with older children. So a lot of our families have already got kids in out-of-home care. So I guess that's relevant to acknowledging the past as well, and particularly for Aboriginal families. And we had a meeting last year where one of the grandmothers was actually able to say to FACTS, you know, I know it wasn't you that did this, but FACTS have torn my family apart and this is the impact it's had. And that was really healing, because from that place we could continue and talk about what needed to happen for this baby. And to me, that was a way of acknowledging the past, and it's kind of almost acknowledging the bigger past in Australia when they've got that opportunity to speak up, and when the white professionals also say, I acknowledge that this is what's happened to you. And I think it's always important to say to them, we acknowledge that you've had this experience, and this is, you know, also in the past experience of Aboriginal people. Sometimes I will apologise that, you know, they've got another Gubba social worker or a white social worker, not an Aboriginal social worker. And I think in some ways that's another way of acknowledging the past in a subtle way. It might sound a bit strange, but it's kind of, it's a respect thing as well. So like I said, I think a lot of the best practice that I witnessed was like social work 101, but it reminded me of the importance of starting where the client is at. And I think since I came back, I've really been aware of the need to just ask them, what do you need right now? Like, what is it that you need? Like, what do you think you need? Not what do all these other people think you need? What is it that you need right now? And be open to the fact it may be totally different to what it appears they need on the surface, and giving space for their voice to be heard. And I think the importance of acknowledging the pregnancy is a big one as well, because often what happens is that when women are assessed as complex or high risk, which I'm a bit allergic to those words, I find them a bit pathologizing, but when they've got lots of vulnerabilities happening, sometimes the pregnancy gets a bit lost, or that the woman as a mother gets lost, because the focus is all on the baby and things like that, or the focus is on addressing their drug use or their housing situation. And at the end of the day, they're a pregnant woman, and they're going to be a mother. And I think there's a lot of power in acknowledging that for them, even if it looks like they're not going to be able to take care of their baby. I'm a big believer in that deep down, like, every woman wants the best for her baby. And they may actually be trying to tell us, I can't do this myself, but I want, you know, somebody to protect my baby. So we need to be listening for that.
In terms of, I guess, particular skills, abilities or knowledge that you've developed from your learnings through the Churchill Fellowship, how is that making a difference for the women that you work at the hospital? And what are those particular skills or abilities that you've developed or changed or shifted up in order to meet their needs?
I think a lot of it has been working on skills around having difficult conversations with women. So it's very easy to try and avoid some of these conversations. Like I said, when we're confronted with, they've already been through so much, and, you know, white social workers have been responsible for so much pain, so I don't want to be responsible for more. But I think it's a respect thing to have a difficult conversation with a woman about, you know, what she needs and about her situation, because it's almost like, sometimes I think of it as like, it's like saying you're worth caring about. Like, so say to a woman, I'm really worried about you and your drug use, or, you know, your relationship. It's a respect thing. It's actually like part of journeying with them. And to do so just because they're an Aboriginal woman and you're frightened about making things worse, is, it's almost like a double standard. I think that witnessing how teams and staff had those difficult conversations in other parts of the world was helpful to think about my own practice. And also, a lot of Indigenous staff talked about having those conversations, knowing that they had the backup of other staff and things like that. So I think thinking about how we can support Indigenous staff to to have those difficult conversations as well and partner with them.
So I thought we might go a little bit of a different direction now and just look at particularly you and what you bring to the work, because social workers don't find themselves in this place doing this particular work accidentally. And I'm sure there's a bit of a backstory about how you came to this place. Looking back on your life, were there any turning points, I guess, that makes it not a surprise you are where you are now doing this work?
Yeah, it's challenging to pick a turning point. I was at a primary school reunion years ago and making small talk, and when people found out that I was a social worker, about three people went, I knew it. And I was just like, oh, really? And that's quite concerning to me, actually. I was like, what does that mean?
They knew it before you realised it.
Yeah, that's right. And it surprised me because, and it's almost a misleading story because I guess I'm not the sort of person that's identified as being like the helper or that kind of thing. But I feel like I've always had an awareness of unfairness and unfair situations, or situations where there's conflict or people not understanding each other and things like that. So I feel like I've always kind of been sensitive to that. I remember saying, why can't we all just divide up our resources across the world? And my parents going, yeah, we tried that, Emma, it's communism. Like, it's been thought of. But I had the privilege of being born on Wiradjuri land in a little town called Wellington and spending my early years there. So it's possible that that had an influence, as there's a large Aboriginal population there. I think my parents were both very community-minded, probably more PNC meetings than placards, but, yeah, just an awareness of others and playing a role in the community and things like that. And Dad was a geography teacher, so he would often make references to, you know, we'd visit somewhere new and he'd talk about the European, or the impact of the European way of life on the landscape and environmental issues and things like that, but also the knowledge that blackfellas had about a place that, you know, the whitefellas ignored or were oblivious to. And I think that was, yeah, I mean, he did that very subtly. It wasn't like, this is what we believe. But in thinking about it, I think that was potentially quite influential. But I kind of feel like I just fell into social work. When I realised I wasn't going to get the marks for psychology, my dad, again, we had a conversation and he was like, oh, I think, you know, psychologists are more like a Toyota specialist, whereas a social worker is like a mechanic that can do lots of different cars and things. And he has no memory of this conversation, but I was like, oh, okay. And so entered social work not really knowing that much about what social workers did, and then on day one of uni thinking, this is amazing, like, I was born to do this. This is I can't believe, you know, there's a profession based on unconditional positive regard, like, yeah. So
it sounds like the values that you hold, you really connected with at uni and you realise, well, this is part of who I am?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to describe it.
Can you name what some of those particular values or beliefs might be that you hold dear in your work and you think, you know, that's part of who I am and that's part of what I learnt growing up?
I think I've always had a belief in there's no us and them, there's only us. So kind of along the lines of we're all in this together. And I often think of that Martin Luther King quote about no man is free until we're all free. So I've always had that sense of while one group struggles, we're all struggling. And particularly in Australia, I guess, while Indigenous people struggle and face adversity, we're all impacted by that, whether we realise it or not. So, yeah, that's really stood out to me. And then I think I have a belief in kind of along the lines of being able to see, you know, both sides of a story and things like that, but that two things can be true at the same time might appear to be in opposition. So a belief in non-dichotomous thinking, or like yes and thinking, and the importance of sitting with ambiguity and mess, which I think is a social work superpower. That's one of the things that we bring to the table, is that ability to sit with mess and distressing situations when people want an easy fix, when the temptation is to seek an easy fix. So, for example, in my current work, I guess that would be like a woman can take, you know, $600 worth of heroin a week, but she can still love her baby. Like, both those things are true. And there are too many Aboriginal children coming into care, and there are Aboriginal children living in unsafe situations. So how do we live with both those realities or address both those realities? I have a belief that everybody's doing the best they can, including staff. Sometimes it's easier to apply that belief to clients than staff, but I think that that's really important. Well, I really value the importance of owning our own story and being real about, I guess, the things that we bring to a situation, and practicing vulnerability and authenticity with, particularly with clients, because more and more, I guess, I value that because I see that the clients do that with us. They practice vulnerability just by turning up and engaging with our service. And it would be easy to say that they don't have to, but I think the fact that they come and they are real with us and really honest, and that even sharing a laugh is testament to the fact that they're, you know, practicing authenticity and vulnerability. So we really need to do the same with them, and we need to do the same with each other. Yeah.
You've already mentioned, I guess, the influence of your parents, particularly your dad. And I'm wondering if there's any other people that have played a bit of a part in some of these beliefs that you hold important today.
I often think about that with these key people, and I almost feel like it's more of a slow burn, like with lots of little interactions along the way or reading or hearing things. I think through my Christian faith and being part of the Uniting Church, that's had quite a big impact, because the Uniting Church is quite social justice focused, and it's kind of led me to learning a bit more about the radical discipleship movement, or what's known as radical discipleship. So looking at the impact of, you know, dominant systems and how that benefits some people and not the vulnerable and the oppressed. So authors like Ched Myers and people like that as part of that movement have been quite influential. In recent years, been quite impacted by the work of Brené Brown, particularly around, so for people that don't know, she's a social worker and calls herself a storyteller researcher, and has done a lot of research into vulnerability, compassion, and this wholehearted living, I guess. But what stood out to me in her work is a lot of this stuff about owning our own story and being willing to stuff it up, essentially, and turn up anyway, which I think is what we have to do in our practice with Indigenous families. Like, we are going to make mistakes. You're going to stuff up. So it's turning up anyway, and it's, being authentic with people. So I think there's a lot about her work that's and she's done a lot of work on shame, which I find really interesting as well. Richard Rohr is another theologian that's kind of been quite influential, because he talks a lot about this yes and thinking and situations where the ego gets in the way, which I think it inevitably can on a daily basis. And we can have very good intentions, but we kind of need to stop and look at what's behind those intentions. But otherwise, I think conversations and just collaborating with Indigenous colleagues or Indigenous community members have been quite influential, because again, I'm just so amazed by how they show up and are willing to, you know, work in partnership with non-Indigenous staff in systems that are still quite racist and may not reflect Indigenous knowledge and values. So I think the fact that, I'm when you look at the history, sometimes I'm just like, how would you even speak to us? Like, it's amazing that you do, but yet they do with such grace, for want of a better word. That's often the word that stands out to me. So I've learned a lot just through, walking alongside them and caring for families with them.
So just before we finish up, I'm aware of the time. Can you give me a bit of a sparkling moment or a good news story, something that's worked since you got back home? What would it be?
Anytime I have a difficult conversation with a woman, can be, and it doesn't end up with, you know, her storming out of the room, or even when it does and she comes back, I think that's a sparkling moment. And, I mean, there's been meetings, I've had meetings about a child coming into care, and we've ended it in laughter. So I think that's not to diminish the pain of that situation, but I think that that reflects just building up that rapport and, yeah, being with the women in that messy, awful space. And sometimes laughter is a good way of relieving the tension. And, again, it's almost like a respect thing. If you can share a joke with someone, it's like a sign of respect. In general, the Aboriginal Maternal and Infant Health Services are a really powerful example of the potential of reconciliation and the impact of just interpersonal relationships at a kind of really small level or an everyday level, because you've got this situation where historically women had a fear of engaging, but now they're presenting earlier, breastfeeding rates have increased and the smoking rates have decreased, both of which will have ripple effects for health, and both of which are things that come from just that engaging with the team. And I think, yeah, building up that relationship, so it has this really powerful ongoing effect that we may not see for a generation or so, but I think we're already starting to see the impact. And even the fact that women will come back to our service after they've had children removed. So I've had clients where I've sat in with them with facts assessments for like 3 or 4 babies, but they still keep coming back to us, which I think is testament that, yeah, we've got that relationship and they trust us, which is really powerful. And we all learn a lot from that and through walking with them. That's probably a big sparkling moment, is any time we have even just a little laugh with a patient. I just think is, yeah.
And what stood out from what you were just telling me is that it really is the team environment, that team culture that makes it work, not just what social worker's doing, but the whole team.
Yeah, absolutely. My role really works because it is part of that bigger team. So it's in conjunction with the midwives. So, yeah, that also is a powerful thing to model to our clients. And it's not just Indigenous women. I think all vulnerable women that we work with, I think it can be a really powerful thing for them to witness our connection and relationship and working together, and that we're behind them. We want to support them.
Great. So what does the future hold for you? Are you going to be writing something up in a social work journal soon? Or
I started writing something up a couple of years ago, and then I had a baby, so I got a bit waylaid. But looking at what the future holds, I'm really interested in exploring a bit more of like Brené Brown's work around shame, but particularly how that applies to owning our own story as representatives of colonial oppressors, or what that means, I guess, and also looking at the impacts of, I think it's really important to acknowledge the ongoing impact of not only working with clients that have a significant history of trauma, but also the impact of even hostility, working in situations where people may not actually want you there or that kind of thing, because I think we're hardwired for connection and that has an impact on us, and we're human first and social worker second. So I'm keen to explore what that means, and in terms of how do we process this stuff so that it doesn't impact our clients, and how do we make sure that we're not practicing in paternalistic ways accidentally. There's still too many Aboriginal children coming into care, and so I'm always interested in how can we engage women earlier that have child protection issues. How do we address, you know, the reasons that they're coming into care, and how do we partner with Aboriginal families and Aboriginal staff to address those reasons? And I'm really interested in just building relationships and having more conversations about what the challenges are and what reconciliation looks like in practice, having conversations about some of the difficult realities and what best practice looks like in the mess, I guess.
So those conversations, are they happening in your local community, or are they a wider conversation that we can be having, I guess, with other social workers?
I would like a wider conversation. I think that, yeah, that would be great. And there's a lot of potential to have a wider conversation, because there's a lot of people I'm aware that are facing the same challenges, and I'm really keen to speak to them and know what people think as part of this moving forward into the future. I'm very open to people.
I was just going to say, anyone listening who feels like that's something they'd like to be involved in, maybe they can get in touch with you. I'd certainly be interested in that too, being involved in that conversation. So we'll talk more. Is there anything else that I've missed today that you'd particularly like to share before we finish up?
I think we owe it to our clients to get skilled up in even things like, you know, the neurobiology of trauma and things like that. I'm really interested in that, which has implications for working with other staff as well. But I think we owe it to our clients to be really skilled in a lot of these things as part of addressing the reasons why kids are coming into care. It's also important to acknowledge vicarious resilience as well as vicarious trauma. So I'm really inspired by just the a lot of the women that we work with. I mean, some of them, they'll say to me during counselling, oh, I guess things could be worse. And I think, I'm not sure they could be. Like, how are you still alive? Like, this is amazing. So the enduring survival of not just Aboriginal, you know, people now, but like the ongoing survival, I think is quite encouraging and is actually an inspiring factor that we can take from practice with Aboriginal people. And their ability to have a laugh, a great sense of humour. And as I said, they can really help you get over yourself and not take yourself too seriously.
Well, this idea of vicarious resilience, you know, it applies to us as social workers too. The fact that we're hearing stories of trauma all the time and the skills that we have to be able to hold that and hold that person and not be affected ourselves by it too shows a form of vicarious resilience too.
Absolutely. And I think it's a form of hopeful practice too. It's a way that we practice, I guess, not being too impacted by it shows that we know that there's hope and that there's another story.
So I'm going to provide a link to the Churchill Fellowship report, which is called, because we didn't really mention it at the beginning, Culturally Competent Ways of Engaging Pregnant Indigenous Women with Identified Child Protection Issues Within an Urban Hospital Environment. So that report you can find on the Churchill Trust website, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes for today. But if people would like to connect with you either online or in person and maybe, join this wider conversation, how might they do that?
At this stage, the best way to do that is via email or LinkedIn. You can find me on LinkedIn.
All right. So I'll get your email address off you and we can put that on the show notes as well as a link to your LinkedIn account. Sounds great.
Fantastic.
Well, I appreciate your taking your Sunday morning to come and talk to me today, Emma, and I'll let you get back to your beautiful family. But, I really appreciate lots of the pearls of wisdom you've shared with us today about social work in the context of a hospital, particularly working with vulnerable women who have child protection concerns. It's the pointy end of the work. It's challenging work. And it sounds like you've learnt a lot going out and connecting with others across the world who have similar issues, and some of these are being translated back in your environment, and it sounds like it's wonderful.
Thanks. Great speaking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Talk the Walk, the podcast putting legs on social work in Indigenous communities through story, music by Flashback Digital. You can access all the show notes from today's podcast at www.metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au. I'm currently on the lookout for inspiring interviewees. If you or someone you know is walking the talk in their work or community, then I'd love to hear from you. You can drop me an email at lucy@metaphoricallyspeaking.com.au or visit my contact page on the Metaphorically Speaking website. Until next time, just keep on walking.